This is Audible.
Recorded books and one-click digital present The Reason I Jump, The Inner Voice of a 13-Year-Old Boy with Autism, by Naoki Higashida. Translated from the Japanese by K.A. Yoshida and David Mitchell. Narrated by Tom Picasso and directed by Andy Paris. One-click digital provides free audiobook downloads in partnership with thousands of public libraries. To see if OneClick Digital's extensive catalogue is available to you, visit your library's website. This book begins with an introduction by co-translator David Mitchell. The 13-year-old author of this book invites you, his reader, to imagine a daily life in which your faculty of speech is taken away. Explaining that you're hungry, or tired, or in pain is now as beyond your powers as a chat with a friend. I'd like to push the thought experiment a little further. Now imagine that after you lose your ability to communicate, the editor in residence, who orders your thoughts, walks out without notice. The chances are that you never knew this mind editor existed, but now that he or she has gone, you realize too late how the editor allowed your mind to function for all these years. A dam burst of ideas, memories, impulses and thoughts is cascading over you unstoppably. Your editor controlled this flow, diverting the vast majority away and recommending just a tiny number for your conscious consideration. But now, you're on your own. Now your mind is a room where 20 radios, all tuned to different stations, are blaring out voices and music. The radios have no off switches or volume controls. The room you're in has no door or window, and relief will come only when you're too exhausted to stay awake. To make matters worse, another hitherto unrecognized editor has just quit without notice, your editor of the senses. Suddenly, sensory input from your environment is flooding in too, unfiltered in quality and overwhelming in quantity. Colours and patterns swim and clamour for your attention. The fabric softener in your sweater smells as strong as air freshener fired up your nostrils. Your comfy jeans are now as scratchy as steel wool. Your vestibular and proprioceptive senses are also out of kilter, so the floor keeps tilting like a ferry in heavy seas, and you're no longer sure where your hands and feet are in relation to the rest of you. You can feel the plates of your skull, plus your facial muscles and your jaw. Your head feels trapped inside a motorcycle helmet, three sizes too small, which may or may not explain why the air conditioner is as deafening as an electric drill. But your father, who's right here in front of you, sounds as if he's speaking to you from a cell phone, on a train, going through lots of short tunnels, in fluent Cantonese. You are no longer able to comprehend your mother tongue, or any tongue. From now on, all languages will be foreign languages. Even your sense of time has gone, rendering you unable to distinguish between a minute and an hour, as if you've been entombed in an Emily Dickinson poem about eternity, or locked into a time-bending sci-fi film. Poems and films, however, come to an end, whereas this is your new, ongoing reality. Autism is a lifelong condition. But even the word autism makes no more sense to you now than the word jihesho, or autismos, or autisma. Thanks for sticking to the end, though the real end, for most of us, would involve sedation and being forcibly hospitalized. And what happens next, it's better not to speculate. Yet for those people born onto the autistic spectrum, this unedited, unfiltered, and scary-as-all-hell reality is home. The functions that genetics bestows on the rest of us, the editors, as a birthright, people with autism must spend their lives learning how to simulate. It's an intellectual and emotional task of Herculean, Sisyphean, and Titanic proportions. And if the autistic people who understand it aren't heroes, then I don't know what heroism is, never mind that the heroes have no choice. Sentience itself is not so much a fact to be taken for granted, but a brick-by-brick, self-built construct requiring constant maintenance. And as if this wasn't a tall enough order, people with autism must survive in an outside world where special needs is playground slang for retarded, where meltdowns and panic attacks are viewed as tantrums, where disability allowance claimants are assumed by many to be welfare scroungers, and where British foreign policy can be described as autistic by a French minister. Monsieur Lelouch apologised later, explaining that he never dreamed the adjective could have caused offence. I don't doubt it. Autism is no cakewalk for the child's parents or carers either, and raising an autistic son or daughter is no job for the faint-hearted. In fact, faint-heartedness is doomed by the first niggling doubt that there's something not quite right about your 16-month-old. On diagnosis day, a child psychologist hands down the verdict with a worn smooth truism about your son still being the same little guy that he was before this life-redefining news was confirmed. And then you run the gauntlet of other people's reactions. It's just so sad.
What, so he's going to be like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man? I hope you're not going to take this so-called diagnosis lying down.
And my favourite.
Yes, well, I told my paediatrician where to go stick his MMR jabs.
Your first contacts with most support agencies will put the last nails in the coffin of faint-heartedness and graft onto you a layer of scar tissue and cynicism as thick as rhino hide. There are gifted and resourceful people working in autism support, but with depressing regularity, government policy appears to be about band-aids and fig leaves, and not about realising the potential of children with special needs and helping them become long-term net contributors to society. The scant silver lining is that medical theory is no longer blaming your wife for causing the autism by being a refrigerator mother, as it did not so long ago. Refrigerator fathers were unavailable for comment. And that you don't live in a society where people with autism are believed to be witches or devils and get treated accordingly. Where to turn to next? Books. You'll have started already, because the first reaction of friends and family desperate to help is to send clippings, web links, and literature, however tangential to your own situation. Special needs publishing is a jungle. Many How to Help Your Autistic Child manuals have doctrinaire spin, with generous helpings of copyright and trademark. They may contain usable ideas, but reading them can feel depressingly like being asked to join a political party or a church. The more academic texts are denser, more cross-referenced and rich in pedagogy and abbreviations. Of course, it's good that academics are researching the field, but often the gap between the theory and what's unravelling on your kitchen floor is too wide to bridge. Another category is the more confessional memoir, usually written by a parent, describing the impact of autism on the family and sometimes the positive effect of an unorthodox treatment. These memoirs are media-friendly and raise the profile of autism in the marketplace of worthy causes, but I found their practical use to be limited. And in fairness, they usually aren't written to be useful. Every autistic person exhibits his or her own variation of the condition. Autism is more like retina patterns than measles, and the more unorthodox the treatment for one child, the less likely it is to help another. Mine, for example. A fourth category of autism book is the autism autobiography, written by insiders on the autistic spectrum, the most famous example being Thinking in Pictures by Temple Grandin. For sure, these books are often illuminating, but almost by definition, they tend to be written by adults who have already worked things out, and they couldn't help me where I needed help most, to understand why my 3-year-old was banging his head against the floor, or flapping his fingers in front of his eyes at high speed, or suffering from skin so sensitive that he couldn't sit or lie down, or howling with grief for 45 minutes when the Pingo DVD was too scratched for the DVD player to read it. My reading provided theories, angles, anecdotes and guesses about these challenges, but without reasons, all I could do was look on, helplessly. One day, my wife received a remarkable book she had ordered from Japan called The Reason I Jump. Its author, Naoki Higashida, was born in 1992 and was still in junior high school when the book was published. Naoki's autism is severe enough to make spoken communication pretty much impossible, even now. But thanks to an ambitious teacher and his own persistence, he learned to spell out words directly onto an alphabet grid. A Japanese alphabet grid is a table of the basic 40 Japanese hiragana letters, and its English counterpart is a copy of the QWERTY keyboard, drawn onto a card and laminated. Naoki communicates by pointing to the letters on these grids to spell out whole words, which a helper at his side then transcribes. These words build up into sentences, paragraphs, and entire books. Extras around the side of the grids include numbers, punctuation, and the words finished, yes, and no. Although Naoki can also write and blog directly onto a computer via its keyboard, he finds the lower-tech alphabet grid a steadier handrail, as it offers fewer distractions and helps him to focus. Even in primary school, this method enabled him to communicate with others and compose poems and short stories. But it was his explanations about why children with autism do what they do that were, literally, the answers that we had been waiting for. Composed by a writer still with one foot in childhood, and whose autism was at least as challenging and life-altering as our son's, The Reason I Jump was a revelatory godsend. Reading it felt as if, for the first time, our own son was talking to us about what was happening inside his head, through Naoki's words. The book goes much further than providing information, however. It offers up proof that, locked inside the helpless-seeming autistic body, is a mind as curious, subtle, and complex as yours, as mine, as anyone's. During the 24/7 grind of being a carer, it's all too easy to forget the fact that the person you're doing so much for is, and is obliged to be, more resourceful than you in many respects. As the months turn to years, forgetting can become disbelieving, and this lack of faith makes both the carer and the cared for vulnerable to negatives. Naoki Higashida's gift is to restore faith by demonstrating intellectual acuity and spiritual curiosity, by analysis of his environment and his condition, and by a puckish sense of humour and a drive to write fiction. We're not talking signs or hints of these mental propensities. They're already here, in the book which, I hope, you're about to read. If that weren't enough, The Reason I Jump unwittingly discredits the doomiest item of received wisdom about autism, that people with autism are antisocial loners who lack empathy with others. Naoki Higashida reiterates repeatedly that no, he values the company of other people very much. But because communication is so fraught with problems, a person with autism tends to end up alone in a corner, where people then see him or her and think, aha, classic sign of autism, that. Similarly, if people with autism are oblivious to other people's feelings, how could Naoki testify that the most unendurable aspect of autism is the knowledge that he makes other people stressed out and depressed? How could he write a story entitled, I'm Right Here, and included at the end of the book, boasting characters who display a range of emotions and a plot designed to tweak the tear glands? Like all storytelling mammals, Naoki is anticipating his audience's emotions and manipulating them. That is empathy. The conclusion is that both emotional poverty and an aversion to company are not symptoms of autism, but consequences of autism, its harsh lockdown on self-expression, and society's near-pristine ignorance about what's happening inside autistic heads. For me, all the above is transformative, life-enhancing knowledge. When you know that your kid wants to speak with you, when you know that he's taking in his surroundings every bit as attentively as your non-autistic daughter, whatever the evidence to the contrary, then you can be 10 times more patient, willing, understanding, and communicative, and 10 times better able to help his development. It's no exaggeration to say that the reason I jump allowed me to round a corner in our relationship with our son. Naoki Higashida's writing administered the kick I needed to stop feeling sorry for myself and start thinking how much tougher life was for my son and what I could do to make it less tough. Virtuous spirals are as wonderful in special needs parenting as anywhere else. Your expectations for your child are raised, your stamina to get through the rocky patches is strengthened, and your child senses this and responds. My wife began to work on an informal translation of Naoki's book into English so that our son's other carers and tutors could read it, as well as a few friends who also have sons and daughters with autism in our corner of Ireland. But after discovering through web groups that other expat Japanese mothers of children with autism were frustrated by the lack of a translation into English, we began to wonder if there might not be a much wider audience for Naoki Higashida. This English translation of The Reason I Jump is the result. The author is not a guru, and if the answers to a few of the questions may seem a little sparse, remember, he was only 13 when he wrote them. Even when he can't provide a short, straight answer, such as to the question, "Why do you like lining up your toys so obsessively?" what he has to say is still worthwhile. Naoki Higashida has continued to write, keeps a nearly daily blog, has become well known in autism advocacy circles, and has been featured regularly in the Japanese Big Issue. He says that he aspires to be a writer, but it's obvious to me that he already is one. An honest, modest, thoughtful writer who has won over enormous odds and transported first-hand knowledge from the severely autistic mind into the wider world, a process as taxing for him as, say, the act of carrying water in cupped palms across a bustling Times Square or Piccadilly Circus would be to you or me. The three characters used for the word autism in Japanese signify self, shut, and illness. My imagination converts these characters into a prisoner locked up and forgotten inside a solitary confinement cell, waiting for someone, anyone, to realize he or she is in there. The Reason I Jump knocks out a brick in the wall. And now, The Reason I Jump.
Preface. When I was small, I didn't even know that I was a kid with special needs. How did I find out? By other people telling me that I was different from everyone else, and that this was a problem. True enough. It was very hard for me to act like a normal person, and even now, I still can't do a real conversation. I have no problem reading books aloud and singing, but as soon as I try to speak with someone, my words just vanish. Sure, sometimes I manage a few words, but even these can come out the complete opposite of what I want to say. I can't respond appropriately when I'm told to do something, and whenever I get nervous, I run off from wherever I happen to be. So even a straightforward activity like shopping can be really challenging if I'm tackling it on my own. So why can't I do these things? During my frustrating, miserable, helpless days, I've started imagining what it would be like if everyone was autistic. If autism was regarded simply as a personality type, things would be so much easier and happier for us than they are now. For sure, there are bad times when we cause a lot of hassle for other people. But what we really want is to be able to look toward a brighter future. Thanks to training I've had with Ms. Suzuki at Hagakume School and my mom, I've learned a method of communication via writing. Now, I can even write on my computer. Problem is, many children with autism don't have the means to express themselves, and often even their own parents don't have a clue what they might be thinking. So my big hope is that I can help a bit by explaining, in my own way, what's going on in the minds of people with autism. I also hope that, by reading this book, you might become a better friend of someone with autism. You can't judge a person by their looks. But once you know the other person's inner self, both of you can be that much closer. From your point of view, the world of autism must look like a deeply mysterious place. So please, spare a little time to listen to what I have to say. And have a nice trip through our world. Naoki Higashida, Japan, 2006. Question 1. How are you writing these sentences? The alphabet grid is a method of non-vocal communication. You might think that speech is the only way to get your points and intentions across. But there is another way to say what you want without using the vocal nervous system. At first, I never dreamed I could make it work. But now, I'm well able to express my true self using only a computer and an alphabet grid. This was an incredible feeling. Not being able to talk means not being able to share what you're feeling and thinking. It's like being a doll spending your whole life in isolation, without dreams and without hopes. Sure, it took a long time before I could finally start communicating via written text on my own. But on that first day, when my mom supported my writing hand in hers, I began to acquire a new way of interacting with others. Then, to allow more independent communication, Mom invented the alphabet grid. The alphabet grid makes it possible to form my words by simply pointing to their letters instead of having to write them out one by one. This also lets me anchor my words, words that would otherwise flutter off as soon as I tried to speak them. Often, while I was learning this method, I'd feel utterly beaten. But finally, I arrived at the point where I could indicate the letters by myself. What kept me hammering away at it was the thought that to live my life as a human being, nothing is more important than being able to express myself. So for me, the alphabet grid isn't just about putting together sentences. It's about getting across to other people what I want and need them to understand. Question 2. Why do people with autism talk so loudly and weirdly? People often tell me that when I'm talking to myself, my voice is really loud, even though I still can't say what I need to, and even though my voice at other times is way too soft. This is one of those things I can't control. It really gets me down. Why can't I fix it? When I'm talking in a weird voice, I'm not doing it on purpose. Sure, there are some times when I find the sound of my own voice comforting, when I'll use familiar words or easy-to-say phrases. But the voice I can't control is different. This one blurts out, not because I want it to. It's more like a reflex. A reflex reacting to what? To what I've just seen, in some cases, or to some old memories. When my weird voice gets triggered, it's almost impossible to hold it back, and if I try, it actually hurts, almost as if I'm strangling my own throat. I'd be okay with my weird voice on my own, but I'm aware that it bothers other people. How often have the strange sounds coming out of my mouth embarrassed me nearly to death? Honest, I want to be nice and calm and quiet too. But even if we're ordered to keep our mouths shut or to be quiet, we simply don't know how. Our voices are like our breathing, I feel, just coming out of our mouths unconsciously. Question 3. Why do you ask the same questions over and over? It's true. I always ask the same questions. What day is it today? Or is it a school day tomorrow? Simple matters like these I ask again and again. I don't repeat my question because I didn't understand. In fact, even as I'm asking, I know I do understand. The reason why? Because I very quickly forget what it is I've just heard. Inside my head, There really isn't such a big difference between what I was told just now and what I heard a long, long time ago. So I do understand things, but my way of remembering them works differently from everyone else's. I imagine a normal person's memory is arranged continuously, like a line. My memory, however, is more like a pool of dots. I'm always picking up these dots by asking my questions so I can arrive back at the memory that the dots represent. But there's another reason for our repeated questioning. It lets us play with words. We aren't good at conversation, and however hard we try, we'll never speak as effortlessly as you do. The big exception, however, is words or phrases we're very familiar with. Repeating these is great fun. It's like a game of catch with a ball. Unlike the words we're ordered to say, repeating questions we already know the answers to can be a pleasure. It's playing with sound and rhythm. Question 4. Why do you echo questions back at the asker? For a long time, I've noticed that people with autism often repeat questions, like parrots. Instead of answering the question, we just say the exact same question straight back at the person asking it. Once, I thought we did it simply because we didn't know how to answer. But now, I think there's more to the mystery than this. Firing the question back is a way of sifting through our memories to pick up clues about what the questioner is asking. We understand the question okay, but we can't answer it until we fish out the right memory picture in our heads. It's quite a complicated process, this. First, I scan my memory to find an experience closest to what's happening now. When I've found a good close match, my next step is to try to recall what I said at that time. If I'm lucky, I hit upon a usable experience and all is well. If I'm not lucky, I get clobbered by the same sinking feeling I had originally, and I'm unable to answer the question I'm being asked. No matter how hard I try to stop it, that weird voice slips out, making me more flustered and discouraged, and so it gets harder and harder to say anything. In set pattern conversations, we manage much better, although, of course, when it comes to talking about your feelings, these patterns are no use at all. In fact, by relying on them too much, you can end up saying the opposite of what you wanted to say. I swear conversation is such hard work. To make myself understood, it's like I have to speak in an unknown foreign language every minute of every day. Question 5. Why do you do things you shouldn't even when you've been told a million times not to? How many times do I have to tell you? Us people with autism hear that all the time. Me? I'm always being told off for doing the same old things. It may look as if we're being bad out of naughtiness, but honestly, we're not. When we're being told off, we feel terrible that yet again we've done what we've been told not to do. But when the chance comes once more, we've pretty much forgotten about the last time, and we just get carried away yet again. It's as if something that isn't us is urging us on. You must be thinking, is he never going to learn? We know we're making you sad and upset, but it's as if we don't have any say in it, I'm afraid, and that's the way it is. But please, whatever you do, don't give up on us. We need your help. Question 6. Do you find childish language easier to understand? Children with autism are also growing and developing every single day, yet we are forever being treated like babies. I guess this is because we seem to act younger than our true age, but whenever anyone treats me as if I'm still a toddler, it really hacks me off. I don't know whether people think I'll understand baby language better, or whether they think I just prefer being spoken to in that way. I'm not asking you to deliberately use difficult language when you talk to people with autism, just that you treat us as we are, according to our age. Every single time I'm talked down to, I end up feeling utterly miserable, as if I'm being given zero chance of a decent future. True compassion is about not bruising the other person's self-respect. That's what I think, anyway. Question 7. Why do you speak in that peculiar way? Sometimes, people with autism speak with a strange intonation or use language in a different way. Non-autistic people can sort out what they want to say in real time while they're having their conversation. But in our case, the words we want to say and the words we can say don't always match that well. Which is why our speech can sound a bit odd, I guess. When there's a gap between what I'm thinking and what I'm saying, it's because the words coming out of my mouth are the only ones I can access at that time. These words are either available because I'm always using them or because they left a lasting impression on me at some point in the past. Some of you may think we read aloud with a strange intonation too. This is because we can't read the story and imagine the story at the same time. Just the act of reading costs us a lot of effort. Sorting out the words and somehow voicing them is already a very tall order. More practice will help, however. Please never laugh at us, even when we're doing a less than great job. Question 8. Why do you take ages to answer questions? You normal people, you talk at an incredible speed. Between thinking something in your head and saying it takes you just a split second. To us, that's like magic. So is there something wrong with the circuitry in our brains? Life's been tough for people with autism, pretty much forever. Yet nobody's really been able to identify the causes of autism. For sure, it takes us ages to respond to what the other person has just said. The reason we need so much time isn't necessarily because we haven't understood, but because by the time it's our turn to speak, the reply we wanted to make has often upped and vanished from our heads. I don't know if this is making a whole lot of sense to you. Once our reply has disappeared, we can never get it back again. What did he say again? How was I going to answer her question? Search me! And all the while, we're being bombarded by yet more questions. I end up thinking, this is just hopeless. It's as if I'm drowning in a flood of words. Question 9. Should we listen to every single word you say? Making sounds with your mouth isn't the same thing as communication, right? Lots of people can't get their heads fully around this, I think. Isn't there a belief out there that if a person is using verbal language, it follows that the person is saying what they want to say? It's thanks to this belief that those of us with autism get even more locked up inside ourselves. Just because some of us can make sounds or utter words, it doesn't follow automatically that what we've said is really what we wanted to say. Even with straightforward yes or no questions, we make mistakes. It happens all the time to me that the other person misunderstands or misinterprets what I've just said. Because I'm barely able to hold a conversation, fixing what's gone wrong is beyond my powers. Every time this happens, I end up hating myself for being so useless and clamming up. Please don't assume that every single word we say is what we intended. This makes communication between us difficult, I know. We can't even use gestures. But we really badly want you to understand what's going on inside our hearts and minds. And basically, my feelings are pretty much the same as yours. Question 10. Why can't you have a proper conversation? For a long time, I've been wondering why us people with autism can't talk properly. I can never say what I really want to. Instead, verbal junk that hasn't got anything to do with anything comes pouring out of my mouth. This used to get me down badly, and I couldn't help envying all those people who speak without even trying. Our feelings are the same as everyone else's, but we can't find a way to express them. We don't even have proper control over our own bodies. Both staying still and moving when we're told to are tricky. It's as if we're remote controlling a faulty robot. On top of this, we're always getting told off, and we can't even explain ourselves. I used to feel abandoned by the whole world. Please don't judge us from the outside only. I don't know why we can't talk properly. But it's not that we won't talk. It's that we can't talk, and we're suffering because of it. All on our own, there's nothing we can do about this problem. And there were times when I used to wonder why non-speaking me had ever been born. But having started with text communication, now I'm able to express myself via the alphabet grid and a computer, and being able to share what I think allows me to understand that I, too, exist in this world as a human being. Can you imagine how your life would be if you couldn't talk? The mystery of the missing words. Us kids with autism, we never use enough words, and it's these missing words that can cause all the trouble. In this example, three friends are talking about their classmate who has autism. Hey, she just said all of us. So, that must mean she wants to join in with us, yeah? Dunno. Maybe she wants to know if we're all doing it. In fact, the autistic girl's all of us came from something the teacher had said earlier on in the day. Tomorrow, all of us are going to the park. What the girl wanted to find out was when they were going. She tried to do this by repeating the only words she could use, all of us. Here you can see how our missing words tweak your imaginations and send you off on wild goose chases here, there, and everywhere. Honestly, what a mysterious language us kids with autism speak. Question 11. Why don't you make eye contact when you're talking? True, we don't look at people's eyes very much. Look whoever you're talking with properly in the eye, I've been told, again and again and again, but I still can't do it. To me, making eye contact with someone I'm talking to feels a bit creepy, so I tend to avoid it. Then where exactly am I looking? You might well suppose that we're just looking down or at the general background, but you'd be wrong. What we're actually looking at is the other person's voice. Voices may not be visible things, but we're trying to listen to the other person with all of our sense organs. When we're fully focused on working out what the heck it is you're saying, our sense of sight sort of zones out. If you can't make out what you're seeing, it's the same as not seeing anything at all. What's bothered me for a long time is this idea people have that so long as we're keeping eye contact while they're talking to us, that alone means we're taking in every word. Ha! If only that was all it took, my disability would have been cured a long, long time ago. Question 12. You seem to dislike holding hands with people. It's not that we don't like holding hands. It's just that if we happen to spot something interesting, we can't help but dash off and let go of the hand we were holding. I don't even remember letting it go until I hear the other person say, "Huh, it looks like he doesn't want to hold my hand." That really used to depress me. But because I can't explain to the person why I let go of his or her hand, and since I do in fact find it hard to keep holding the hand for long, there's not much I can do about the misunderstanding. It's really not a matter of whose hand I'm holding, or even of the act of holding hands itself. It's this impulse kids with autism have to dart off to anything that looks remotely interesting. This is what we have to tackle. Question 13. Do you prefer to be on your own? Don't worry about him. He'd rather be on his own. How many times have we heard this? I can't believe that anyone born as a human being really wants to be left all on their own. Not really. No, for people with autism, what we're anxious about is that we're causing trouble for the rest of you, or even getting on your nerves. This is why it's hard for us to stay around other people. This is why we often end up being left on our own. The truth is, we'd love to be with other people. But because things never, ever go right, we end up getting used to being alone, without even noticing this is happening. Whenever I overhear someone remark how much I prefer being on my own, it makes me feel desperately lonely. It's as if they're deliberately giving me the cold shoulder treatment. Question 14. Why do you ignore us when we're talking to you? If someone's talking to me from somewhere far off, I don't notice. You're probably thinking, same here, yes? A major headache for me, however, is that even when someone's right here in front of me, I still don't notice when they're talking to me. Not noticing, however, is not the same as deliberately ignoring. But often people assume I must be arrogant or retarded. People around me always make me realize that I'm being spoken to by saying things like, "Say hello back then, Naoki," or "What do you say then?" So whenever that happens, I just repeat what I've been told to say, like a minor bird learning a new word. Even though I feel guilty toward the person who has spoken to me, I can't even apologize. So I end up feeling miserable and ashamed that I can't manage a proper human relationship. A person who's looking at a mountain far away doesn't notice the prettiness of a dandelion in front of them. A person who's looking at a dandelion in front of them doesn't see the beauty of a mountain far away. To us, people's voices are a bit like that. It's very difficult for us to know someone's there and that they're talking to us just by their voice. So it would help us a great deal if you could just use our names first to get our attention before you start talking to us. Question 15. Why are your facial expressions so limited? Our expressions only seem limited because you think differently from us. It's troubled me for quite a while that I can't laugh along when everyone else is laughing. For a person with autism, the idea of what's fun or funny doesn't match yours, I guess. More than that, there are times when situations feel downright hopeless to us. Our daily lives are so full of tough stuff to tackle. At other times, if we're surprised or feel tense or embarrassed, we just freeze up and become unable to show any emotion whatsoever. Criticizing people, winding them up, making idiots of them, or fooling them doesn't make people with autism laugh. What makes us smile from the inside is seeing something beautiful or a memory that makes us laugh. This generally happens when there's nobody watching us. And at night, on our own, we might burst out laughing underneath the duvet or roar with laughter in an empty room. When we don't need to think about other people or anything else, that's when we wear our natural expressions. Question 16. Is it true that you hate being touched? Personally, I have no particular problem with physical contact, but sure, some people with autism can't stand being hugged or touched. I don't know why, to be honest. I guess it just makes them feel uneasy. Even the way we adjust our clothing to match the season, putting on more clothes in winter and fewer in summertime, this can be a very big deal for people with tactile issues. Acting accordingly as situations change is a tough call. More generally, for a person with autism, being touched by someone else means that the toucher is exercising control over the person's body, which not even its owner can control properly. It's as if we lose who we are. Think about it. That's terrifying. There's also the dread that by being touched, our thoughts will become visible. And if that happened, the other person would really start worrying about us. You see? We put up a barricade around ourselves to keep people out. Question 17. Why do you wave goodbye with your palm facing yourself? When I was small, I used to wave goodbye with my palm facing inward when I was told, "Wave bye-bye." I found simple gym exercises and dancing quite impossible. The reason is that imitating movement is difficult for people with autism. Because we don't know our own body parts so well, moving those parts of the body we can track with our eyes is our first step toward imitating movement properly. I never understood people when they told me that I was waving goodbye the wrong way around, until one day I saw myself in a full-length mirror. That was when I realized I was waving goodbye to myself. Slip sliding away. "I can run faster than any of us," said the hare, boinging away.
"But we had a race a long time ago to settle this, and I won," said the tortoise crossly. "I'm the fastest."
None of the other animals was at all interested. "Ah, who cares?" But the hare insisted on having another race, so the tortoise finally gave in and turned up at the starting line. The race between the hare and the tortoise was about to start. "Ready, set, go!" The hare dashed away at terrific speed. The tortoise slipped and flipped over onto his back, at which all the other animals ran up to the tortoise to see if he was all right.
"Poor you. Are you okay? You'd better go home and rest."
And so they all carried the tortoise back to his house. The hare reached the finish line. Nobody was waiting but himself. Question 18. When you're on one of your highs, what's going through your mind? Sometimes people with autism start laughing like a hyena or appear to be having enormous fun on their own without any obvious reason for it. You must be wondering, what on earth's gotten into him? At times like these, we're having imaginings. Or not quite imaginings, but we experience pictures or scenes in our minds that pop up out of nowhere. Maybe it's the memory of something that made us laugh, or maybe it's a page from a book we read. This might be hard for you to understand, but try to see these highs as a stronger version of those times when you remember something funny and can't help but chuckle about it. Question 19. What are your flashback memories like? We do remember what we did, when, where, who we did it with, and things like this, but these memories are all scattershot and never connected in the right order. The trouble with scattered memories is that sometimes they replay themselves in my head as if they had only just taken place. And when this happens, the emotions I felt originally all come rushing back to me like a sudden storm. This is a flashback memory. I know I have lots of pleasant memories, but my flashback memories are always bad ones, and from out of the blue, I get incredibly distressed, burst into tears, or just start panicking. Never mind that it's a memory from ages ago. The same helpless feeling I had then overflows and floods out, and it just won't stop. So when this happens, just let us have a good cry, and then we can get back onto our feet. Maybe the racket we make will get on your nerves a bit, but please try to understand what we're going through and stay with us. Question 20. Why do you make a huge fuss over tiny mistakes? When I see I've made a mistake, my mind shuts down. I cry, I scream, I make a huge fuss, and I just can't think straight about anything anymore. However tiny the mistake, for me it's a massive deal, as if heaven and earth have been turned upside down. For example, when I pour water into a glass, I can't stand it if I spill even a drop. It must be hard for you to understand why this could make me so unhappy. And even to me,